Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, who discusses the recent escalation of guerrilla attacks in Baghdad and the future of the U.S. military occupation. Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, who describes the October 25th March for Peace in Washington, D.C., and renewed activism opposing the U.S. military occupation of Iraq. And Jennifer Rodriguez, an immigration attorney, who explains the harsh penalties for many undocumented immigrants arrested by U.S. authorities. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After a decade of churning through American courts, a class-action lawsuit filed on behalf of 30,000 indigenous people in Ecuador, focusing on the toxic waste created by Chevron Texaco's oil-pumping activities, is finally going to trial. The oil giant is charged with dumping waste into hundreds of unlined pits that later leaked into the surrounding environment and poisoned drinking water in the Amazon forest region. According to the Guardian newspaper, plaintiff lawyers led by Ecuador native Cristobal Bonifaz argue that Texaco saved $4 billion by not reinjecting the waste back into the oil wells, a common practice in the United States. The legal case against Chevron Texaco also claims the company discharged up to 4 million gallons of toxic wastewater a day that carried heavy metals. A recent study by Petro Ecuador, the state oil company that now operates Texaco's oil concession, found that over 1,000 families still live near the old oil pits in the Ecuadorian Amazon. Nearly all of those surveyed claim their health was harmed by Texaco, and 55 local people have died of cancer. With the trial now in progress in Ecuador, indigenous groups and environmentalists hope justice will soon prevail. For the past 2 years, Belarus leading scientist Yuri Bondyshevsky has been locked in a prison cell in the capital city of Minsk. His alleged crime, according to prosecutors, in one of Europe's most repressive regimes, is that he accepted bribes from students in exchange for better grades. At the time, Bondyshevsky was head of the well-respected Gomel State Medical Institute. But the World Press Review reports there is little credible evidence to back up these charges. Instead, supporters of the 46-year-old pathologist say he is being harassed for his outspoken remarks linking low-level radiation still present near the Chernobyl nuclear plant with health problems in school children. In 1993, Bondyshevsky's wife, Galina, a cardiologist, released a study connecting low-level radiation from cesium-137 to heart and nervous system ailments in schoolchildren. In 1999, Bondyshevsky publicly criticized the state's efforts to minimize the danger of radiation as ineffective before the Belarus parliament and on TV. Soon afterwards, the scientist's legal troubles began. He was arrested and jailed for 6 months, then later released to stand trial. Bondyshevsky was ultimately sentenced to 8 years in jail. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe says Belarus violated its own penal code 8 times in prosecuting Bondyshevsky, but he still sits in a Minsk jail. Ellen Spearman is not sure where her next meal will come from as she sits in her trailer home in rural Nebraska. The 49-year-old mother of five, who used to make $9 an hour at an energy company, needed surgery for a benign tumor. Soon afterwards, she lost her medical benefits and was later laid off. Now, Spearman survives on disability payments and child support. However, she earns too much money to qualify for food stamps. On most nights, supper for the Spearman family consists of lots of rice, biscuits, and gravy with a little meat when affordable. According to The Nation magazine, 33 million Americans are classified as food insecure, not knowing where their next meal is coming from. The number is likely to rise as the official poverty rate grows to nearly 12%. In the early 1970s, the U.S. government launched the Women, Infants, and Children Nutrition Program that was designed to alleviate the most severe cases of malnutrition. But since Ronald Reagan started cutting nutrition programs in the early 80s, the buying power of these programs has diminished, resulting in food pantries, which many communities have launched to meet the emergency food needs of the poor. In most cities, food banks often rely on donations from supermarkets and food producers, resulting in a very limited and unhealthy selection of food. Activists are still optimistic that hunger in America can be eliminated. As David Beckman of the Christian-based group Bread for the World observed, $6 billion in 2 years could cut hunger in half. It's an eminently solvable problem. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
The recent rocket attack on Baghdad's Rashid Hotel, followed by coordinated suicide bombings targeting the International Red Cross and four police stations, signal an escalation of guerrilla attacks aimed at the U.S. military occupation of Iraq. The wave of bombings killed 36 and wounded more than 200. Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, one of the Bush administration's key architects of the U.S. war on Iraq, was in the Rashid Hotel when the rocket attack occurred, but was not injured. Despite the new wave of deadly attacks on U.S. forces and their Iraqi allies, the White House is continuing its public relations campaign, emphasizing what they describe as the positive aspects of the occupation and progress in pacifying Iraqi resistance. As a result of the continuing violence, humanitarian organizations such as the UN and Red Cross have reduced their staffs working on relief projects in Iraq. The violence has also diminished prospects that the Bush administration will get assistance in the form of thousands of foreign soldiers it has requested from nations around the world to support and legitimize the U.S. occupation of Iraq. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, who discusses the recent escalation of guerrilla attacks in Baghdad and the future of the U.S. occupation.
The human toll among Iraqis has been quite horrific. Somewhere near 40 dead, something like 250 injured, almost all of them Iraqis. This comes after the attack on the Al Rashid Hotel, in which an American, high-ranking American military official was killed, and a number of others were injured. I think that what we're seeing is a very far cry from anything remotely resembling success on the part of the occupation authorities, and the notion that Bush could sort of look at this and say, well, this shows that we're succeeding, means that his understanding, forget his understanding of what Americans know, but just his understanding of what Americans see day to day, what pictures they see on their television screens, is completely out of touch with reality. They clearly don't have a clue how to respond to this. And I think that what we're seeing is a very dangerous escalation. A not surprising escalation. I mean, we did hear that the attack on the Al Rashid Hotel, for instance, which is inside the so-called Green Zone, the most highly protected sector of Baghdad, in which the highest-ranking military and civilian occupation authorities are living, that they were able to attack this with a gadget that one of the high-ranking U.S. officials called a science project made in a garage. This was not a sophisticated project. It didn't have to be. There are stockpiles of rockets and grenades and RPGs and other kinds of military hardware all over Iraq. Much of it has not ever been put under lock and key, put under guard since the U.S. occupation began. So I think it's quite likely that we're going to see a continued escalation. This was a apparently coordinated set of attacks. I doubt that we have seen the last of it. What is particularly disheartening, of course, is that humanitarian organizations like the International Committee of the Red Cross and Red Crescent, the ICRC, which was targeted late last night or early this morning, where 12 people were killed and a number of others injured, they are paying the price much as the United Nations paid the price for being perceived as working under the terms of the U.S. occupation forces. And this is a very serious crisis because it means that even when the U.S. occupation is finally deemed a failure, and I have no doubt that it will be at some point, and there will be an end to that occupation, it will make it much more difficult for the U.N. and the Red Cross and other humanitarian organizations to work in Iraq despite how much it's needed, because they will be perceived as having collaborated with the United States occupation. So this is a very serious level of escalation that we're seeing.
The United States was recently jubilant about its unanimous approval in the United Nations Security Council for a U.S.-sponsored resolution, which, by the Bush administration's accounts, legitimized the American occupation of Iraq. And I wonder if you would comment on that, as well as the donors conference that occurred in Madrid, and the Bush administration's hope to get foreign troops into Iraq to assist American forces in the occupation.
Well, both the donors conference in Madrid and the UN Security Council resolution were aimed at supporting, getting international support and credibility, very crucially, for the U.S. occupation. The pressure on the Bush administration domestically is escalating. The public and congressional antagonism to the proposal to spend an additional $87 billion, primarily to maintain the occupation of Iraq, only secondarily, in fact, only $15 billion of that $87 billion is actually earmarked for reconstruction work. $65 billion, the vast majority of that money, is to go directly to the Pentagon and to the corporations that are outsourcing the Pentagon's work. So the pressure was mounting, and the administration felt compelled to try and go back to the international community and beg and borrow and pressure other countries into agreeing to provide funds. And in the United Nations, they were hoping that they would provide troops as well. Now, in fact, it's very clear that this is, in both cases, largely a Pyrrhic victory. In the Security Council, while it was a unanimous vote, all of the major players followed the vote by saying that this was not going to lead them to provide additional troops. It was not going to lead them to provide additional funds. And it did not mean that they viewed the U.S. occupation of Iraq as legitimate. They passed the resolution for reasons that have more to do with fear of U.S. repercussions if they refused than it did with actual support for the U.S. position.
What, in your view, is the outlook for the United States occupation of Iraq and the eventual transition to an Iraqi-run government?
Right now, the trajectory of the U.S. occupation does not look like it's moving anytime soon towards Iraq being able to reclaim its sovereignty. But what we are seeing is a clear escalation, and the U.S. seems to have no answer to it. There's no answer beyond, we're making progress, things are getting better, they're attacking because they're desperate. Right now, it seems to me that the desperate ones are the spin masters in Washington.
That was Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of the book Before and After, U.S. Foreign Policy and the September 11th Crisis. Contact the Institute by calling area code 202-234-9382 or visit their website at www.ips-dc.org. After an absence of more than 7 months from the nation's streets, opponents of the Bush administration's war on Iraq came together again by the tens of thousands on October 25th in Washington, D.C., San Francisco, and dozens of other communities around the U.S. The rallies, jointly sponsored by two major coalitions which had organized a series of powerful protests before the start of the war earlier this year, called for an end to the occupation of Iraq and to bring the troops home now. Organizers of the largest protests in the nation's capital said that 100,000 demonstrators attended the event, while Park Police estimated the crowd at half that number. While the size of these protests clearly did not match those of the several giant pre-war rallies in New York and Washington, organizers said that they had exceeded their expectations and predict that the movement opposing the occupation would continue to grow. The diversity of the crowd reflected concern about the ongoing conflict in Iraq across generations, with both young people and those who had participated in Vietnam War-era protests marching side by side. The presence at the protest of military veterans and family members of soldiers now serving in Iraq indicated growing alarm at the numbers of U.S. casualties in the war that was launched last March. Since the conflict began, 350 U.S. troops have been killed, with 211 dying after the president declared an end to major hostilities. Receiving less publicity are the large numbers, possibly more than 10,000, Iraqis who have been killed in the war thus far. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Leslie Kagan, national coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, a co-sponsor of the October 25th protests. She describes the rallies for peace and renewed activism opposing the U.S. military occupation of Iraq.
United for Peace and Justice, one of the major national anti-war coalitions with about 650 different member groups. We were one of the co-sponsors, along with International Answer, of a march on Washington, as well as a demonstration, a major demonstration in San Francisco, and then many, many dozens of cities around the country and around the world picked up the call also and also took people to the streets. In Washington, we had upwards of 100,000 people, which far exceeded, I think, any of our expectations. Probably most significant for many of us was the fact of a very large contingent of people from military families, that is, people who have relatives often sons and daughters, but other relatives as well, now serving in the military, and many, many of them serving in Iraq or in that theater of operations. That very large contingent, as well as a very large presence of veterans, all of whom came together to join with thousands of other people to say it's time to end the occupation of Iraq and bring the troops home, we sent a very powerful message, not only to the Bush administration and to the Congress, but to the people of this country and people around the world, that this demand is a critically important one. But also, we very much communicated that the anti-war movement is alive and vibrant and strong and committed to doing the work that needs to be done.
One of the big messages coming out of the rally was to bring the troops home. And it was interesting. I heard one of the three radio networks in their coverage of the Washington March to Stop the War, and they described the message coming out of the October 25th rally as a call, quote unquote, to abandon Iraq. Very highly charged words and a description. How do you respond to those who say that pulling out U.S. forces now from Iraq would be a recipe for disaster, both for Iraq and the United States?
Well, you know, that's been said before in other situations. People said during the Vietnam era, we can't leave because there would be a nightmare, there'd be a bloodbath. And in fact, when the U.S. left Vietnam, that's when the war ended, and the bloodbath stopped. Anybody who thinks that things are peaceful and calm and life has gotten back to normal for the Iraqi people is not aware of what's really going on there. You know, life is far from normal almost every day. Literally every day we see reports of U.S. troops and service people being attacked, being sabotaged, being ambushed, whatever. We believe the responsibility of our government should be to take the troops out, turn control of the Iraqi government and the Iraqi resources back to the Iraqi people. If the Iraqi people ask for assistance from us or from other governments in the world, then by all means we should give them assistance. We, especially the U.S. government, has caused tremendous damage, not only through this war, but also through the first Gulf War 13 years ago, and through the many, many years, over a decade long, of sanctions against Iraq. So, yes, I don't think we have any problem with saying that, you know, U.S. aid to Iraq, should be considered, should be given. But this $87 billion that Congress is about to sign over to the president is not for the rebuilding of Iraq. It's for the maintenance of a military occupation. And you can't rebuild the country. You can't move to creating democratic institutions and getting life back to the normalcy under the yoke of a military occupation. So we think it's in both the short-term and the long-term interests of the Iraqi people to end the military occupation.
Leslie, what are the plans for the coming year by your coalition, United for Peace and Justice, and other groups working against the U.S. occupation?
Well, we're going to do our best to keep the pressure on to try and really bring this occupation to a speedy end and bring the troops home. We have, of course, a full agenda as United for Peace and Justice. Our next kind of major mobilization will be in Miami at the end of November around the FTAA meetings, the Free Trade in the Area of the Americas. One of the priorities for UFPJ this year is to really help people see the links between corporate globalization and militarism and the rush to war of the Bush administration, all under kind of the banner or the unifying theme of empire building, or from our point of view, trying to stop the empire building agenda of the Bush administration. We're also looking forward. United for Peace and Justice has already kind of put out a hold the date call for March 20th. March 20th will be the one-year anniversary of the beginning of the war against Iraq. And so we're planning now, some efforts. It may be more decentralized, not necessarily a march on Washington or a march in New York, but a slightly more decentralized effort to really mark that day by putting people out in the streets again. And, of course, more long-term, we're looking ahead to the Democratic Convention in July up in Boston and the Republican Convention here in New York City in August next year. During the election year, we think it's very vital that we address the many, many issues that are of concern to our communities and push those so that those people who are running for office have to take a stand one way or the other.
That was Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice. To contact United for Peace and Justice, call area code 212-868-5545 or visit their website at www.unitedforpeace.org. Federal immigration officers raided Walmart stores across the country on October 23rd, arresting 300 cleaning crew workers they suspect of being undocumented foreign workers. The raids at 61 stores in 21 states were part of an investigation into whether the world's largest retailer or its subcontractors knowingly hired illegal immigrants. Issues surrounding immigration, how many immigrants enter the U.S. every year, whether or not they take jobs from native workers, and whether they hurt or help the economy, have been the focus of much political conflict. But several in-depth studies have revealed certain facts. For example, 8 out of 11 immigrants enter the country legally, either to join a close family member or on student, tourist, or workers' visas. Many visa holders then overstay their visas, putting them at risk for deportation. Only a small minority arrive in the U.S. with no paperwork whatsoever, and these individuals make up the most exploited group of immigrants. Studies show that immigrants do not take jobs away from native workers. Rather, they do the work few others are willing to do, or they set up businesses in their own immigrant communities, generating jobs. Immigrants as a group pay more in taxes than do native-born citizens and receive less in government services. Even undocumented immigrants pay about the same in taxes as they receive in benefits. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Jennifer Rodriguez, an immigration attorney in Connecticut. She explains what is likely to happen to the immigrant workers arrested at Walmart and the harsh penalties facing many undocumented immigrants arrested by U.S. authorities.
If they don't have papers and they don't have some other way to stay here, they could be deported if they had a very close family member, a parent or a spouse that's a U.S. citizen, or a child over 21 that's a U.S. citizen. They could petition for the non-citizen to stay here. There are times when people go before the immigration court and they're ordered deported, and then they're given the chance to appeal, or they're allowed to leave the courtroom, but with a date to be set in the future when they have to show up at immigration to be deported, and then the person just doesn't show up on that date. There was a pilot program in the Hartford immigration court that went on for 6 or 8 weeks, which was trying to deal with that problem. At the end of the person's immigration hearing, if they lost the hearing, the immigration service would detain them. Then the individual would have to ask for a bond hearing. The bond hearing may not have been held that day. It was usually held either that day or the next day, in which the person had to explain why they were not a flight risk. And the immigration court would set a bond for the person. It could have been as low as $1,500. However, I personally knew of cases where the judge put down $15,000, $100,000, $250,000. So if a person were ordered deported and not left, the next time they get picked up, immigration does not let them go until they're put on a plane and brought back to their home country.
Of the people that you deal with in your law practice, can you just sort of summarize the main reasons why people come, if you can?
Well, we have a very general immigration practice here. We have all sorts of people come in. We have people who come in who have gotten married and they want to file for their spouse. We have parents who want to file for their children, or adult children wanting to apply for their parents. We have people who work for employers that want to sponsor them. We handle not directly visitor visas or student visas, getting them, but we help the people once they're here to decide what options are available for them to be able to stay here legally. Then we do handle deportation cases, and we help people who want to become citizens.
Do you have a sense of most people wanting, proactively wanting to come here, or do you talk to clients who feel like they were forced to come here because of, you know, globalization and the incredible reach of the American economic system, where it benefits people in the U.S. but actually hurts people in other countries, and they don't have any way of making a living anymore.
There are many people that come here to my office and indicate, I came here, I was just planning on coming to visit, or I came here, I was planning to visit, and then I needed to make a little bit of money while I was staying here, and I got a job, and I realized how much more I could make here. So, and then there are people who come here purely with the intention to work while they're here, but their intention is to work for a couple of years, save some money, and then be able to go back home. And many of these people find themselves here 5-10 years later, realizing that their life is here now, and they need to find a way to stay here.
The four demands of the immigrant workers' freedom ride included being able to basically just, you know, to come into the country, to reunite families, to, you know, be able to be first-class, quote-unquote, citizens, I guess, or to be on the track towards citizenship. Some people in the U.S. argue that, you know, if we open the borders, everybody in the world is going to end up in the U.S. because they can make more money and life is harder in most of the countries they come from, that kind of thing. Do you see any downside to that? I mean, I know a lot of people who worked on that rally and on that whole issue felt that anybody should be able to come who wants to.
It's a nice idea to let anybody who wants to come, come. Politically, that's just not going to happen. I think a fair and just political solution now would be some sort of amnesty for people who have been here for a certain amount of time, and then set up a more reasonable, equitable system to have people come in the country once the people who are already here are taken care of. A lot of the people who come here and stay here and build their lives here miss their home countries, and they wish they could have their life that they have here in their home country.
That was Jennifer Rodriguez, a Connecticut immigration attorney. For more information on immigrant rights, call the AFL-CIO at area code 202-637-5018 or visit their website at www.aflcio.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.